Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you're listening to Total EM. We are back for evidence-based medicine and EB medicine special, and we are going to talk a lot about them at the end, but just make sure to understand that if you want to see some more information, go to their website. We'll have links in the show notes. But this week, we are going to talk about anaphylaxis, specifically in pediatric populations. And part of the reason why I want to mention this is because we haven't talked about anaphylaxis since podcast number 19. So years ago, we talked about this. We haven't touched it since then. And when it comes to pediatric patients in particular, this diagnostically can be a challenge, as well as overcoming the steps sometimes of what we need to do to appropriately treat patients, because a lot of times when we have anaphylaxis, A, we fail to recognize it, and B, we fail to administer epinephrine early, which can lead to its own sets of complications, which we'll talk about more here momentarily. But I wanted to hit with the pediatric cases, kind of some of the barriers of obtaining the history and physical, as well as knowing the appropriate dosing of medications. And because also pediatric cases in general provide us with quite a bit of stress when managing these sick patients. So we're going to dive a little bit into those topics, as well as some of the other things from the EB Medicine article. Again, make sure to check it out, but let's go into the details. I'm not going to go into the specific numbers with blood pressures for patient ages, but I will talk about a couple of key points, and that is that there are three main diagnostic criteria when it comes to anaphylaxis that most people will recognize. The first one is that you have an acute onset of reaction within minutes or hours involving skin and/or mucosa paired with either respiratory or cardiovascular compromise or collapse. The second diagnostic criteria is the set of symptoms that develop from an exposure that is likely an allergen. Any of the following two categories are needed for the diagnosis of anaphylaxis: involvement of skin and/or mucosa, respiratory compromise, cardiovascular collapse, or gastrointestinal symptoms. The third diagnostic criteria is for a patient has reduced blood pressure after exposure to a known allergen within minutes or hours. Hypotension is usually defined as a systolic blood pressure less than 90 millimeters mercury or a 30% decrease from baseline. We usually use this mostly for adults, but in children, it's a little more challenging. Remember that those less than 10 years of age have a separate definition. We tend to think of this, at least with, like, for example, PALS or pediatric advanced life support, that will take the blood pressure of age at a minimum of 70 and will times it by 2 of the age. So for an example, if you have a 5-year-old child, 70 plus 5 times 2, well, 5 times 2 is 10, so 70 plus 10 is 80. So a systolic blood pressure less than 80 is concerning. Now, there are other methods out there, and there are things that you can use instead, but if you keep this general rule of mind and noticing systolic blood pressures less than this point can be at least beneficial as a precursor to easy diagnosis of anaphylaxis. We will talk more about treatment here in a moment, but we should also think about some other things, such as the common causes of anaphylaxis. Now, we think of it generally as being foods, medications, or insects. Foods that are commonly causing anaphylaxis are peanuts, tree nuts, shellfish, eggs, and other types of additives. Anaphylaxis is a little less common in general fish, sesame seeds or sesame products, milk or additives, but we do still see it. And one thing that they didn't talk about, but we're seeing it more with alpha-gal, is meat products. In particular, red meats are usually the culprits there. When we're talking about medications, most commonly these are antibiotics or NSAIDs. And then with insects, we're talking about like bees, yellow jackets, wasps, and sometimes ants. We frequently have concerns of biphasic anaphylactic reactions, but they are uncommon. And biphasic reactions are generally defined as recurrence of symptoms within 72 hours without a re-exposure to the trigger. This can be very challenging because what exactly is the trigger is usually known after the fact, sometimes with allergy testing or with further evaluation at the home setting. But in general, you know, if we have a known allergen exposure and they aren't re-exposed within that 72-hour period, that's most likely a biphasic reaction. Most of these will occur within minutes or some cases maybe a couple of hours afterwards, but we're usually seeing very rapid return of symptoms. Now, with some limited evidence, we're able to find that biphasic reactions essentially don't occur if you're able to fully control the symptoms within 30 minutes of treatment, which can be really helpful when we're trying to figure out which patients can go home. The bigger concern, especially with biphasic reactions, are which ones are going to have fatal anaphylaxis, which is what we care about most. Fortunately, the fatal anaphylaxis rate is calculated to be only about one death per million people per year. So very, very low rates of anaphylaxis that lead to death. Pediatric populations who have anaphylaxis, that mortality rate is less than 1%. Where we tend to see most of our fatalities with anaphylaxis are in elderly patients, especially with medications, which accompany about 59% of these, versus food, which is more like 7%. Another interesting finding from the EB Medicine literature review is that less than 15% of patients who had fatal anaphylaxis had cutaneous symptoms. What does that mean? Well, that means that they were essentially not having a rash. And when we lack having a rash, a lot of times these patients are easy to miss because we're not always thinking about it first and foremost. So for example, if someone comes in with a severe asthma attack or COPD exacerbation based on the picture because of wheezing and stuff like that, we might miss the chance of seeing that hypotension along with wheezing and history of known allergens as, hey, this could be anaphylaxis and not a bad COPD exacerbation or asthma attack. And when we see that, we need to keep in mind that there's a broad differential, which is sometimes why we lead to giving people epinephrine during such events, because if it does arise from anaphylaxis, that epinephrine can be truly life-saving. So again, we have to remember that the cutaneous findings may be uncommon in anaphylaxis, especially in those that lead to fatal events, and that we have to keep a broader differential in mind when we have these atypical presentations. Like I said, a good history and physical will make all the difference. Asking about potential triggers and symptoms can readily identify anaphylaxis versus other causes, especially when we think about comorbidities that can lead to biphasic reactions or fatal anaphylaxis. The physical exam, however, is a little less impressive in many cases. So in anaphylaxis, we might see edema or urticaria, and we might see some wheezing, but we tend not to see very many other physical exam findings. Vital signs, though, are going to be very beneficial, especially when we're looking for any signs of hypotension. Keep in mind that normal heart rates and blood pressures, again, will vary with pediatric patients. If you're waiting to see a little more about what are risk factors for biphasic reactions or fatal anaphylaxis, we have a table from EB Medicine in the show notes. Again, check that out at totalem.org under Emergency Professionals, podcast number 170. All right, so early recognition is key. We understand that we've asked a good history, we've performed a good physical, and we really are concerned that this is anaphylaxis in this child or adult for that matter. What do we do next? The most important thing, the first thing we need to do is to give epinephrine. Now, for in the pre-hospital setting, maybe we're at someone's home and they have a history of anaphylaxis and they have an epinephrine auto-injector, this is going to be something that's key to at least get them to the time to get them to the hospital. Usually with epinephrine auto-injectors, they should come in pairs. That way, if there's failure of one device or if they have a biphasic reaction, because again, it's going to happen usually within minutes, less commonly within hours of the symptom onset and treatment, we want to keep in mind that we need to give the dosing. It is much better to give it intramuscularly versus subcutaneously because we hit peak plasma concentrations intramuscularly much faster than we would subcutaneously. Now, IV dosing can be beneficial, but again, in the pre-hospital setting or in early treatment, let's not worry about the IV. IVs can be delayed and can delay care itself. So again, we want to focus in on IM dosing. The IM dosing for pediatric patients is usually using 0.01 milligrams per kilogram of a 1 milligram per ml vial. And the concentration can be up to 0.5 milligrams total that's delivered. So keep in mind that 0.01 milligrams per kilogram is your dosing versus using other medications or other dosing regimens, which may lead to a 0.1 milligram per kilogram. So one more time, the appropriate dosing of epinephrine when given initially, especially IM, is 0.01 milligrams per kilogram up to 0.5 milligrams. if we decide to give this IV, maybe because we've already done IM, we've gotten IV established early, and they just aren't getting better, the next thing that we're going to do is that we can give boluses IV of epinephrine. Now, this is where more commonly we find mistakes in dosing and dosing errors that can lead to complications. The article from EB Medicine does detail some of these complications in pediatric patients, which is why it's so important to remember the maximum dosing of that 0.5 milligrams. But usually we're using far fewer doses and far fewer concentrations in this. So remember, if you're ordering 0.5 milligrams, back up, because realistically, what you're probably wanting to do is more to a 50 microgram maximum dosing. So what is the IV dosing? Well, it depends on who you ask. I'm going to mention two different ones and their dosing regimen ranges, but understand that there's no real set standard. If you're giving IV, the second symposium on the definition of management of anaphylaxis recommended a dosing of 0.2 micrograms per kilogram up to 10 micrograms for persistent hypotension. However, the Resuscitation Council from the UK's guidelines talk about 1 microgram per kilogram up to 50 mics IV. And then if you're looking at an IV infusion, the Resuscitation Crisis Manual, I really like it. I think it's a great pocketbook for quick reference for things like this when I don't remember all the dosings for everything. They recommend IV infusions of 1 to 20 micrograms per minute. Now, remember that this is pediatric dosing that we're trying to gauge for, and that the Resuscitation Crisis Manual is giving adult doses. So I would try and think of it as, say you're on that higher end of the dosing scale. Maybe with your boluses, you're doing 10 mics a bolus, then maybe that should be more of starting out a little bit lower and working your way up to that 10 mics infusion. Again, this is going to be based on multiple factors, and PALS, or Pediatric Advanced Life Support, can provide some guidance there too. The next important part that we need to consider, and this is usually done in conjunction with giving epinephrine, is airway management. These patients in rare cases may require intubation or, in worst case scenarios, surgical intervention. More commonly, though, they may require supplemental oxygen or breathing treatments, including albuterol. This is especially true if wheezing is present. If there's significant edema, consider early intubation. Now, sometimes with that epinephrine, you may be able to turn the corner really quickly, so it's worth trying it, but you should not delay airway management if it does look like you're entering into an area where immediate airway collapse is going to be a real concern, because it is much easier to get to the intubation early versus having to move to a surgical airway. And as a tip that I try and remember is that if you have someone who has anaphylaxis, you're going down the pathway of needing to intubate this patient, you should have a surgical airway set up, because this is predicted to be a difficult airway. So this isn't the time where you just think about where is the surgical airway kit, but to have it out and ready to go if needed. All right, so we've taken care of the immediate life threat, and we've used PALS if needed, we have delivered epinephrine, and we've managed the airway as needed. What do we do next? What are the other things we can do? Now, we've talked about this a little bit more back in podcast 19, but just to kind of rehash it here, there is some evidence, given not great, but there is some evidence that you can use antihistamines. These are your H1, H2 receptor blockers. So classically, this is diphenhydramine or Benadryl and using ranitidine or Zantac. Generally, these doses are going to be more in that 0.1 milligram per kilogram range, but it's worth always having kind of a quick reference guide to remember exactly what the doses are. The other thing to do is to give a steroid. Now, some people will use methylprednisolone, some people will use dexamethasone or prednisone or any other option. The key is to remember that you're giving some sort of steroid to help prevent biphasic reactions. Now, the evidence here, again, is not really strong, as with most evidence from anaphylaxis, because it's not like you can randomize control trial these patients in many cases to one arm or the other for, say, example, epinephrine, but we can use other studies like observational trials to help better understand what is being done and what difference it makes. Overall, though, in general, for cutaneous symptoms, using antihistamines can be beneficial, as well as using corticosteroids to help prevent other symptoms or biphasic reactions. Let's say you've controlled that, but they still need some more epinephrine because they still have some persistent hypotension, respiratory distress, stride, or whatever. You're going to keep doing epinephrine. That should still be your first line. Giving IV fluids is necessary for any hypotension, as well as consider doing those beta agonists like albuterol, as we've discussed before, for the wheezing. But let's say, especially that we gave that one dose of epinephrine, we have given them the antihistamines and the steroids, they're doing great, symptoms have resolved within 30 minutes. Now what do we do? What's the disposition? For those patients, I strongly consider discharge. Now, different guidelines are going to suggest different things, which is why it's so important to reference and use these materials when you can to help your decision making. You can keep people for maybe a couple hours or less. Keep in mind, most of these biphasic reactions are occurring within the first couple of hours. But who do you need to keep for longer? Well, those that aren't getting better within that 30-minute time window from treatment, I would seriously consider keeping them unless they've had significant improvement shortly after that 30-minute window and they lack the risk factors where I'm worried about fatal anaphylaxis. If people have risk factors concerning for fatal anaphylaxis, most likely you'll want to keep those people if at all possible. This can always be a challenge though, because how long do you keep them? Remember, the definition of biphasic reaction is 72 hours, but in some of the trials that we've seen, they extend it further out than that. Does that mean you need to keep all your anaphylaxis patients who don't resolve quickly and without any complications to need to be admitted for, say, a week or even 3 days? I really don't think so. I think for the most part, we're going to kind of monitor them. And maybe if there's concerns about them getting home and being able to return quickly and safely, or if there are other factors that we are generally worried about, these people should probably stay for a longer period of time. If you want to know a little bit about what are some of the risk factors for fatal anaphylaxis, it actually depends on what induces it. So, for example, with venom-induced anaphylaxis, really cardiovascular disease is our known one there. For drug-induced anaphylaxis, we know that older age or underlying respiratory or cardiovascular disease, such as asthma, COPD, stuff like that, leads to a more likely event of fatal anaphylaxis, given, again, very rare, as we talked about before. With food-related anaphylaxis, it's a few more things. So, age, especially in younger patients, underlying asthma, if they have known allergens, especially peanut or tree nut allergies, the absence or delayed use of epinephrine, or the maintenance of an upright posture during symptoms are all concerning that these could be findings related to fatal anaphylaxis as they can develop. Now, there's an excellent clinical pathway that EB Medicine developed for this, and it goes through everything of what we're talking about. For the patients that you decided are going home, these are the ones where you want to think about, okay, they're symptom-free on discharge. We have a way to get them an epinephrine auto-injector to use for future emergencies, as well as having a way to set them up with primary care or an allergist, if not both. Anyone else, I'm at least considering hospital admission. Now, a lot of patients, if they are symptom-free, are not going to be willing to stay, and you might find a hard time with your hospitalist or pediatrician about keeping these patients even overnight for observation if they have resolution of their symptoms. But it is something to keep in the back of our minds that these are patients that we need to consider admitting them, if not keeping them for a brief period of observation of several hours. Ultimately, anaphylaxis is a pretty common event for us to see and is frequently missed. We often have concerns with giving epinephrine, which we shouldn't, because epinephrine is the key to management here. Everything else is secondary as far as what we do. It is still very important to consider antihistamines, corticosteroids, and of course, airway management. So me working in the emergency department as a PA, what do I do? I keep in mind a very broad differential when I see patients and understand that especially when we have critical appearing patients, and when I see the critically ill patients, I'm keeping in the back of my mind, could this be anaphylaxis, and be willing to give epinephrine early. I find a lot of my colleagues, physicians, PAs, NPs, and also our RNs who are helping manage these patients frequently fail to recognize the need to give epinephrine and fail to recognize just in general the diagnosis of anaphylaxis, and will send people home with persistent symptoms, and then they bounce back. And these are scary patients to have bounce back, because if you fail to recognize them the first time, they are at higher rates of fatal anaphylaxis. So for me, this is an important podcast to share because I see this mistake continue to happen. So I hope that you can take this away and learn more through other resources, especially the EB Medicine article. Like I said, if you enjoy this information, if you want to learn more about EB Medicine, go to their website. We have a special link in the show notes. If you go to that link, you can get a discount, and it's $50 or more, especially if you're a PA or NP, you can get a really good discount. Just go to the website and check it out. And if you go through our link, you can save additional money. But if you have anything else, any other questions, any experiences, feel free to reach out and make your comments known. Be happy to talk to you more about it. Be happy to cover more about particular subjects if you're interested. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.